This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A new state Supreme Court ruling puts the kibosh on county prosecutors having investigators that start their own cases. McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers talks about the implications for drug asset forfeitures elsewhere in the state.
You know, out of LaSalle County, out of from a dollars and cents standpoint, did it pay off? Sure, if you're looking at it from the accounting aspect. There's also a public trust aspect as well.
Chambers tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker that he'd rather spend money on lawyers to clear cases than on investigators. Plus, Mayor Terry Renner and Alderman Amelia Burgess of Bloomington stop by. And hog farms continue to make a big news stink in the state. All that and a GLT news update on the way. It's July 11th, 2017, and this is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A major east-west thoroughfare is now included in the City of Bloomington Bicycle Master Plan. Aldermen voted at the regular meeting to amend the plan to include Washington Street. Aldermen also received a budget report from Grossinger Motors Arena. Aldermen started with a special meeting at 5:15 that included a presentation from Police Chief Brendan Hefner. That presentation, at the request of five aldermen, was instead of a vote during the regular session meeting on a new civilian review board. In the studio, as he is most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings, is Mayor Terry Renner, and he's joined this week by Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess. Thanks to both of you for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having us.
So, Terry, should members of Black Lives Matter, the ACLU of Illinois, the YWCA of McLean County, Not in Our Town, should they be concerned that last night was a presentation and not a vote?
I don't think so. I think at this point, the council, I think the majority of the council at least, sees the benefit of having another set of eyes, a civilian advisory review board. And let's make it clear, that's purely what it is. It's an advisory board. And frankly, when I was at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, most metro mayors have these exact same kinds of issues. They handle it in many different ways. The mayors of Miami Beach and Miami, for example, if there is a complaint against how an officer has behaved that involves physical force, they do not investigate themselves. It's the Miami-Dade Sheriff's Department that conducts an independent investigation. So there are any number of structures and ways that this could be handled. But it certainly doesn't seem to be unreasonable, I think, certainly not to me, to a majority of the council, that you have another set of eyes, civilians, taking a look at a situation if someone feels that the internal process was not just.
Okay. Amelia, let's bring you in here. You were not one of the five aldermen who requested that presentation from Chief Hefner. Why was that? Are you ready to vote on this issue?
Well, I was not asked to sign on to that particular proposal for last night. However, I always appreciate the opportunity to have more public input from the community, as well as to have more opportunity to discuss this particular issue with the other council members, as well as the chief of police, and to get his perspective on the current system and how it is working, so we can really make the most well-informed decision moving forward.
All right, Terry, where is this ultimately headed? Are we going to be seeing a vote here in a couple of weeks?
I believe it's scheduled for the 24th.
Okay, great.
So, and that'll be probably the main event. In fact, I was just speaking with City Manager Hales before I came here, and we're working out the agenda for the 24th, and that'll be the main item on that agenda. So there'll certainly be further options for public comment, further council discussion, and then a vote. But since there are several moving parts to this, there'll be a draft ordinance, and there'll be a couple of different options for the council to consider. So, for example, there's a concern as to whether or not you allow felons to ever serve on this, you know, board. There are some who would argue, you know, let's say you were 18 and you stole $400 and were convicted of a felony. Does that mean if you're 55, you should not even, maybe you're integrated back into the community, you're a functioning member of the community, does that mean you should never be able to serve on this? So that's, I think, at least a legitimate question. Or do you include maybe violent felons, or is there a particular time period if the last 7 years or something? So there will probably be a couple moving part options for things like that, in addition to the, in a sense, the boilerplate ordinance that people have already seen. And so then the council can make that determination and decide, do we want that piece? Do we want another piece? And then vote on the 24th of July.
So did either of you learn anything new last night as Chief Hefner spoke to Alderman about the prospects of a police civilian review board?
I didn't learn anything new. But some of this information has been presented. It's all public information. Some we certainly have heard from different people during public comment. The Alderman had a chance to discuss this in greater detail and some of the issues. I don't think many minds were changed, but there was certainly nothing there that you couldn't have received on the city's website.
Okay. Amelia, what about you?
I think last night helped to clarify for me, because we had the presentation by our police chief, who has made a lot of substantial changes to how business is done in Bloomington and made a lot of strides in improving community relations. And so we had that perspective, and then we had the perspective of the residents who say that they're not fully satisfied, or they believe, or I think actually a better way of putting it is they want to make improvements so that citizens are more comfortable with the process. And that, seeing both of those side by side, began to really help me better understand what the true issue is. And it's not that anything's necessarily broken. It's more looking at, can we be better? Can we be more proactive? Can we approach this in a different way that is more comfortable for citizens and will help us identify areas of concern? Not necessarily areas where people have done anything wrong or mistakes have been made, but areas where we can improve and begin to address some of these perhaps differing perceptions of interactions that we have. Because we can have interactions between officers and citizens where both individuals walk away with very different perceptions of what just happened. And that's not a sign anyone did anything wrong, but it is a conversation we should be having about how we can fix that and get everyone on the same page.
Right. And I absolutely agree, and Amelia brings up a good point. We may know, the council and the mayor may know, that Brendan has instituted some really important reforms, but not necessarily everyone in the public realizes that. And so I think that's critical. The other piece is we are going to be moving toward police body cams. And with body cameras, one of the things that the evidence clearly shows us is that that reduces the harm not only to the officer, but also to the to civilians. And so we're going to begin to experiment with that in the fall. And so it seems as if everybody's behavior changes a little bit when they're on camera. And so this is just one of many pieces, as Alderwoman Burgess has suggested, in what we can do in terms of community outreach. If you know your community and you're a police officer, you know your neighborhoods, and I think most of our officers do. Most of our officers are outstanding, frankly, and most have college degrees, have served in the military. They know their beat, they know their neighborhoods, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't a few people who might make mistakes. And when they do, there is a question: should you internally just be able to investigate yourself? And the civilian review board concept is there will be another set of eyes of civilians who are purely advisory, and they would refer back to the police chief.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. He's in studio today with Alderman Amelia Burgess. So back to you, Mayor Renner. What did Alderman approve last night as it relates to bike lanes on Washington Street?
Well, I think it's a very, very significant ordinance, and we certainly need to congratulate Alderwoman Amelia Burgess, who's been championing this and many other things. I think it's really critical to have an east-west corridor. This, let's be clear, will take several years to actually implement. And so I strongly support it. I'm very excited about it. I think that there are things that we may very well tweak as we go forward, but that's where the devil is in the details.
Amelia, you work closely with advocates on the project, and the lanes actually go in front of your house. What did you learn about the process?
Well, it's been an extensive process. We started, it started about 3 years ago. And I've been working on it for the last year or 18 months, barely beginning to reach out to the neighborhood, look at some of those concerns. And we heard comments last night that were very positive in that process, how this proposal has improved over time, how it has reflected some of the comments we've received. But like anything, there are a variety of opinions, especially when it comes to changing our modes of transportation and how we design that, because this really is a substantial change for the community here, both in Bloomington and Normal. We both adopted a complete streets ordinance last year, and that is a dramatic change in how we move forward on transportation planning. But it can be a very positive change, because what we're saying is, regardless of how you get around in town, everyone should enjoy the same basic levels of safety, convenience, and accessibility.
So I understand there were some last-minute concerns that popped up about parking in the downtown area, maybe. I guess what do we say to business owners who might be concerned about that related to these bike lanes?
Sure. One of the great benefits of planning ahead is it gives us time to minimize potential negative impacts. We know that if we move forward in this plan as it's currently envisioned, we will lose a small number of parking spaces in the downtown area. For the most part, they're not directly in front of businesses. They're in areas that have surface lots that are adjacent. But because we've approved this now and we won't be implementing it for several years, we can make sure that if we do end up losing those spaces, there's really no impact, that we can make sure that those businesses are fully accounted for and that people find parking to be in the downtown area just as accessible as it was before, if not more so.
And just to clarify that, is that we are in the process and have purchased strategic properties to begin to alleviate some of the parking issues in the short run and perhaps then become sites for economic development in the future. So this is all a work in progress. So we are, as I say, we want our historic core, our cultural core, to be a centerpiece for our community and be one of the means by which we grow our local economy in the 21st century. And so we are going to be ever mindful of parking and accessibility. But Emilia is absolutely right. This is the future, and that is multimodal cities where you have people who are biking, who are driving, who are walking, who are using public transit. And that's the 21st century city. And this, I think, is one of those major steps forward in us achieving those goals.
Well, given that's the future that you see, do you think that the next bike lane that pops up will be as controversial as it goes for approval?
I don't think so. I think, in fact, when I was at the U.S. Conference of Mayors a couple weeks ago, the Miami Beach, which is very skinny and very tight and very congested, has bike lanes everywhere. And I was talking to some of the cab drivers who were driving us back and forth, and they said, yeah, it's a little scary at first, but you get used to it. You just have to slow down. And I think that that's much of what we will see, is if you've got smaller lanes, people are going to, generally speaking, not travel quite as fast. People who are on bike lanes are, generally speaking, safer than if they were driving on that same road without a bike lane. So I think Rome will not fall. In fact, quite the contrary. I think we'll begin to see some of the benefits of this. People will get used to it, and we will move forward. Making progress is not always easy.
This is Sound Ideas. In the studio today are Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner and Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess. Let's talk about the Coliseum, which I'm sure I will accidentally call it the Coliseum a number of times today. It is now known as Grossinger Motors Arena.
We flip back and forth on that, too.
Okay. The facility experienced an operating loss of almost $674,000 in the past year. So, Terry, what are your goals for this facility financially? And then, Amelia, if you can jump in, and your goals for the arena as well. And can VenueWorks reach these goals?
Well, it would be nice to break even in terms of the operating costs. We knew this year that that was not going to happen because there are a lot of transition costs and there were capital things that we needed to spend money on. We also knew that we did not have naming rights. That in of itself would take $175,000, for example, off the table. So certainly that would be important. One of the things that I drove home last night, because I continue to hear this, is problems with concessions, that the lines are way too long. And as I have joked, if somebody wants to come to the Coliseum and pay way too much for beer, we need to have somebody there to take their money. And so, and I realize that there are some perhaps issues where chip cards are slower than cash or whatever, but we don't need excuses. We need results. We need answers, especially since this involves a considerable amount of money. So my goal would be to get us to break even in terms of the operating costs. But let's also be clear that the impact of the Coliseum since its inception has been about $150 million to the community. So often we only focus on the cost side. We should also recognize the benefit side, the asset side of the ledger.
Yeah. Amelia, what about you?
Yeah, and I think the mayor raises some very important points. Number one, we have to continue looking at that bigger picture, that the operating budget is not the only impact that this Coliseum has on our finances in the city of Bloomington, and that when we have full shows and we have these popular country bands coming in, we have people in downtown, they are buying things, they're spending money in our community, and that has a significant impact on our financial success as a city. But also, I think what we need to start doing is setting reasonable expectations. And these need to be based on data. They need to be set based on expectations from what we see in other communities. What can we achieve at the Coliseum? Let's set those reasonable expectations and let's start meeting them. Because the problem is we have never met the expectations that have been placed on the Coliseum. We need to define what those are, what they are realistically, and start meeting them. And I think that will help people feel more comfortable with the arena's presence in this community and to really start looking and focusing on that bigger picture.
And then one of the things is that if we have, and certainly I've been trying to not only advocate that, but obtain an anchor project across from the Coliseum so they're not an island that's away from the core of downtown activity, then that'll certainly help them get more events. If they get more events, more people come downtown. There's less, red ink for us to cover. So I think there are a lot of very possible, strong advantages. And there's some serious interest in inventing and investing in the area south of the Coliseum in the Warehouse District. Although that'll probably be downtown 2.0 or 3.0. There certainly seems to be some substantial amount of interest there. So 10 years from now, hopefully that entire area will be an engine of economic growth for the community.
I guess what role does the naming rights deal that we just made with Grossinger Motors, what does that play in the upcoming future health, financial health of the arena? How important is that?
Well, it's important for $175,000 a year. Amelia?
Yes, but it's also important from this whole notion that we're rebranding. We're starting fresh. We have a new management company. We have a new name. We have a new image. So we can really reset expectations here and really build excitement about having this within our community and all the benefits that it provides to us.
I think it's a great point. This is not your grandfather's Coliseum, right? This is the Grossinger Arena, and we're moving forward with VenueWorks.
So suite sales are lagging, too, after a rules change by VenueWorks. I think that was included in the report they delivered. What's your understanding of that issue, Terry?
Well, in the short run, I did ask a question about that, that they had changed policy. And in the short run, it has cost the bottom line. We're losing money. Now, they are arguing in the long run that these changes in policy will improve revenue, and we will see. And that's definitely something that I, and I'm sure the council and others, will be keeping a very close eye on. And if the deals of the past were more profitable, then we need to reinvestigate this.
Sure. So VenueWorks operates facilities across the Midwest. Are we seeing any economies of scale coming into play yet, where maybe they've booked acts at other facilities that they operate or own, and they actually get that act to come and make a stop at Bloomington too?
I think only in one situation, but we're early in the operations. They've really only taken over a little over a year ago, and it takes a long time to book gigs. But they do have several. They've had some people who go from Dayton, Ohio, and I know the mayor there actually very well. She speaks very highly of VenueWorks, to Racine, Wisconsin, and John Dickert, the mayor of Wisconsin, speaks very highly of VenueWorks. So, and they could come to here, and then Des Moines, Iowa, where they also have a very strong reputation, So it's possible that they could get more gigs that are a Midwest tour.
All right. So Amelia Burgess and Terry Renner, thank you for your time on Sound Ideas. Amelia Burgess is the city's Ward 4 alderman, and Terry Renner is 2 months into his second four-year term as Bloomington's mayor. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Grinnell Mutual, offering auto, home, farm, and business insurance products for over 100 years to help people protect what's important today and into the future. Trust in tomorrow. More information at grinnellmutual.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The Illinois Supreme Court recently issued a ruling in a case that will affect how some county state's attorneys do business. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers about the state of Illinois versus Ringland, which comes out of LaSalle County. Chambers says it involves an investigator for the state's attorney's office there who was making drug stops along Interstate 80. Chambers says the defendants argued that the evidence should be thrown out as improperly gathered.
And the motion to suppress was based on whether or not, well, based on several issues, but what the Supreme Court ruled on was who made the stop. Because the state's attorney's office, the state's attorney statute allows for state's attorneys to have investigators who have some of the same authority that the police would have. There are some counties which basically have investigators who are have decided to have investigators kind of operating as traffic officers, where they're out on a highway, on a road, looking for traffic violations. They make stops. They end up doing searches incident to those stops. If there's anything that would be drug-related or other crimes, but most of the time it would be drug-related, they would then pursue an asset forfeiture based on that. And the asset forfeiture could be cash, it could be some other item of value, it could be the vehicle. But in this situation, it was a criminal case. There were narcotics found in the vehicle. There was a motion to suppress based on, was the state's attorney's office able to, was it within their authority to have a police officer basically, you know, have their own police force that would start cases, that would start those investigations?
And why did the state Supreme Court decide, no, that's not okay?
They reviewed the statute, and, you know, there's a lot of the case was dealing with statutory construction, which is the word that attorneys use in terms of looking at the statute and saying, what does this mean? Because there's sometimes it's obvious, there's sometimes it's not, and there's other times where they look at it and they say there's parts of it that conflict, or the court will say, we're not sure what they meant, but they have to follow these rules. And one of the rules also is an interpretation of it unjust, or is it, from a practical standpoint, a bad idea? And what they looked at was different one language that said they could, that a state's attorney's office could have basically this police force or investigators who investigate crimes. But also on the other side, there's another provision which says they can do that to assist law enforcement, to assist in investigations. They define that to mean assisting ongoing investigations, not starting new ones, not starting new investigations.
What is the legitimate purpose in having the prosecutors have their own investigators to work on ongoing investigations rather than just saying, hey, police agency, we need you to take a deeper look at X, Y, or Z issue or X, Y, and Z potential for evidence?
So there could be various circumstances if police are particularly overloaded with their caseload. Maybe if they don't have expertise in a certain area, you could have an investigator who would assist them. Also, there are other things people could be doing as state's attorney investigators that aren't investigating. For example, service of process would be one thing that they would be allowed to do. Finding witnesses, maybe transporting them to trial, doing follow-up interviews at the last minute. Those would all be things that might be considered that weren't covered by this statute.
Why would any prosecutor want to spend part of his or her budget on that rather than on lawyers to handle the caseload?
I don't. That would be my answer to that. But every county is going to be different. I feel like in McLean County, I and my prosecutors have a good relationship with our local police departments. We don't always agree, but we don't let the times when we don't agree get in the way of the times when we do agree. So if there's something where I want follow-up in a case or one of my prosecutors wants follow-up in a case, we usually call the police department and say, hey, can you go do this? Personally, I think it's better for just the continuity of the case if the same people who were doing that investigation are also doing the follow-up for it. I do think that's better, and that's why I have not pursued doing that in McLean County.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers about a new state Supreme Court ruling, which we should point out does not affect McLean County because McLean County is not doing any of the conduct the state Supreme Court ruled to be improper. How big an effect will this have around the state? How many counties do have these investigators and these arrangements?
I think it will have the biggest effect on those counties that actually have those divisions, where they've hired somebody who is the investigator, who has a squad car, who maybe has the radar to do traffic enforcement. They've got that the dash cam. I believe there was one county that had a canine unit as well. Those counties have made a financial investment in those units, and they're not going to be able to pursue those anymore.
Did the investment pay off in increased drug asset forfeiture? And is that does that make you feel squeamish?
From a dollars and cents standpoint, You know, out of LaSalle County, out of, from a dollars and cents standpoint, did it pay off? Well, sure, if you're looking at it from an accounting aspect. There's also a public trust aspect as well. And did it pay off in that regard? I guess time will tell on that. But that's something where I mean, I'm not comfortable doing it because, you know, police are police and prosecutors are prosecutors. And as much as we might be on the same side 98% of the time, I think it's important that we be separate entities. I've never been a fan of consolidation of power. The idea of me basically saying, in addition to prosecuting, I want to have my own police force, my own countywide police force, I think that's an unnecessary consolidation of authority that we don't need.
How could it affect public trust?
Well, I think in general, people don't want to see a consolidation of authority and power that way.
Do they really see it? Arguing for the moment about LaSalle County, dollars to donuts, the reason that that system grew up the way it did was because of Interstate 80, which is a major thoroughfare, and a lot of people use it legitimately, but some people use it not legitimately. So they might be focusing on drug interdiction on the I-80 corridor.
And I think it's important to note, I mean, we do pursue asset forfeitures, not just for drug cases, but also financial crimes, and also what's called Article 36s.
Right, but in the case of LaSalle County, it's unlikely that that would be targeting local folks.
Right, right.
So there's not a local public trust issue.
We've got three interstates that go in five different directions. We do have a substantial amount of that traffic that comes through here and that is paid attention to. But one thing that's an important difference is it is rare for us to have a situation where there is an asset forfeiture that also doesn't have a criminal case linked to it. In some counties, that's not occurring. In some counties, there are a notable percentage of cases where there's an asset forfeiture, but no allegation of criminal conduct.
And that, of course, is controversial. The ACLU has targeted that over the years.
And I'm not going to say that I would never have a situation where I pursue that, but it's not our regular matter of course.
Should that even be an option to you, though? The ACLU would argue not.
And if there's a change on that, I will respect that change. And obviously, I'll have to respect that change. But you won't hear me grumbling about it. Anytime you have discretion in a statute or case law, you're likely to have somebody who wants to push the boundaries of that. Sometimes I appreciate it. There's other times where I look at it and I'm like, yeah, I'm not gonna do that.
So you have to go for the center, and you have to hope that the people who in those positions where discretion is allowed are trustworthy.
I think that's spot on. And not necessarily also trustworthy, but there's sometimes people with good intentions get overzealous, and it's important sometimes to take a step back and think, how does this look? And to always remind ourselves that most of us have heard the idea that it's better that 9 guilty people go free rather than 1 innocent be convicted. And these aren't criminal cases since they're asset forfeitures. But I think the same thing applies. We don't want to be seizing stuff wrongfully.
McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The state Supreme Court did not rule whether investigators hired by county prosecutors violate the illegal search and seizure provisions of the state constitution. Turning now to agriculture, large hog farms have been more common recently, but that doesn't mean they haven't been controversial. They're still concerned over odor, pollution, and the welfare of animals. For Illinois Issues, Deborah Chandler Landis reported on those hog farms. Daisy Contreras spoke with Landis.
You wrote about confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs. And you mentioned in your story that Illinois ranks 4th in the United States for pig production. If this is the case, why are some people opposed to having these types of farms in Illinois?
They stress that they're not anti-pork, not anti-agriculture, but they believe that reforms are needed in the state of Illinois as to how these confinements are operated and regulated. They're quite concerned, I think, about how pigs are crammed in, for lack of a better word, into small confinements. Sometimes thousands of pigs can be in one barn, one facility. And they're also concerned that there's not enough oversight as to the pollution that can come if there is a leakage of manure, and also how many are coming up in such large numbers across the state.
It's interesting that you bring up oversight and accountability. There was actually legislation considered this session that would address those issues. Can you tell me a little bit about those measures and where they ended up in the General Assembly?
The measures did not make it out of committee. There was what Senator David Kaler, who introduced them, described as strong lobbying efforts by the Illinois Pork Producers, the Farm Bureau, Beef Association. The proposed legislation dealt with all kinds of livestock capos, not just pork. But the law strove to do a few things, including having the large hog farms and medium-sized hog farms register with both the EPA, state EPA, and the state agriculture department. And they also would provide greater opportunity for county boards to have input and local residents. And it also talked about the importance of having what they called agricultural plans to deal with manure and fertilizer that's made from the manure.
I want to go a little bit more into what are some of the arguments supporting pig farms. You spoke to some owners as well. What did they have to say about the issue?
Right. I spoke with a Phil Borgic. He is a pig farmer in Raymond, Illinois, and his dad was a pig farmer. He says raising of pigs offers an opportunity to have greater control over the pigs. For example, it's easier to herd them in if they're inside rather than outside. And he also said that raising them indoors protects them against inclement weather and predators. And he also said that it allows for greater efficiency of raising pigs and has allowed to have younger family members interested in farming to stay in farming.
And speaking about farming as a family business, many times for generations, as you've mentioned, what kind of revenue do CAFOs bring to the state of Illinois?
The Illinois Pork Producers Association, I don't have that off the top of my head, but it's literally millions of dollars in tax revenue that the pork industry produces, they say. And they note, for example, that this rising demand for pork and the subsequent rising numbers of hog farms, it results in more jobs in the actual raising of pigs, but it also extends to the processing, the transportation of pigs, as well as helping grain farmers, because pigs, they said, eat millions of pounds or tons of corn and soybeans.
But yet there's also this issue of, you know, some of the opponents arguing that pollution is an issue with keeping CAFOs. What are some of the already existing laws that tell people how CAFOs can be set up?
There are a list of steps, if you will, that people who want to build a hog farm have to go through. And that includes how are they going to take care of the manure and the waste, how the facility will be built. From what I've picked up, where the problem lies in, it doesn't spell out exactly what these farms should do if a problem occurs, or how are they going to make the public, if you will, knowledgeable. One of the measures that didn't make it out of committee in the spring called for the Ag Department not to approve a permit for a facility that had a bad record, if you will, of manure spills. There's also concerns because the manure is stored in underground pits usually, and they use it for fertilizer. And what if they make a mistake in how they apply the fertilizer? That's a concern, and because of obviously because it can too much manure can get into waterways, affect the soil, and also they say that been some spills that have resulted in fish kills, mussel kills, but the Illinois Pork Producers Association says that can't be tied exactly to seepage from hog farms. Maybe it was existing pollution. So there's an ongoing debate about that.
Pig farming businesses also change depending on the current demand, especially with what is asked by the restaurant sector that buys from these farms.
I think from what I understand, there is a move. I was told that pig farmers, if there is enough call to move away from CAFOs, they may well listen and adjust to demand for that. Because I found it interesting that several restaurant chains, corporations are asking for pork that hasn't been raised in CAFOs. So it'll be interesting. It will be interesting to see how this evolves.
So in some sense, it all comes down to ethics and how these animals are being raised.
Right. And that's right, because I've heard some people say how they currently do it is inhumane. Well, I've heard other people like this Phil Borjic say, I wish people could see the care that we take for these pigs. You know, they're well cared for, because if we didn't take care of them, Mr. Borjic said, we won't have a good product. But again, it does come down, and, you know, that's a great point about ethics and how we want to raise livestock and how we want to proceed in getting it processed.
Deborah Chandler Landis reports on the controversies surrounding large hog farms in Illinois for Illinois Issues.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Listen to Here and Now weekdays at 1 p.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Those who gaze at the skies will have a big day next month in central Illinois, a solar eclipse. The moon will pass in front of the sun and cause darkness in the day from the moon's shadow. This is the first total solar eclipse seen from the U.S. in 40 years. Some of the best viewing August 21st will be in southern Illinois, though it may not be bad in McLean County. Lee Green is with the Twin City Astronomers. Green tells Judy Valente, eclipses are not all that uncommon. They happen every 6 months somewhere around the world. Less common is the upcoming transit across the U.S.
This will enter the U.S. By Portland, Oregon. It will be going west to east, go over Casper, Wyoming, over Carbondale, Illinois, Nashville, Tennessee, and then exit the U.S. at about Charleston, South Carolina.
Will we actually be able to see it here in central Illinois?
We will have a partial eclipse here in Illinois. The sun will be partially covered by the moon. That is, an eclipse happens when the moon comes between the Earth and the sun. And it will be going through that process. It will take about an hour for that moon to go across the sun. That is, it comes in on one side, it partially obscures the edge of the sun, it eventually obscures more and more of it.
And what time of day will this be taking place?
This will be in the early afternoon, about 1:30. Here we will have about a 93% eclipse. So we will see the sun as a very, very thin crescent. Even though 90% of the sun is covered, it's not safe to look at it. It is just still too bright, and you must be able to use an other way to observe it. You can use projection. That is, if you look at the sunlight coming through the trees, they will show the crescents. If you use your fingers crosshatched to provide little spots, those will then project onto the sidewalk as crescents.
And you brought some special glasses here. I'm wondering what those are and what would they do?
The eclipse glasses are a low-cost plastic medium, but its purpose is that it blocks most of the light. About 99% of the light is blocked. So the only thing you can see through these is the sun.
And they look like those 3D glasses that you get at the movie theater. That's what they look like.
Exactly. They're just light cardboard with two places. They look like just two little plastic pieces for your eyes to look through.
And where can you get those?
There's a number of places online. If you Google or if you search for eclipse glasses, you will find them.
And how much do they cost?
They're about $1 a piece.
But the thing is, you should not look at the eclipse with your bare eyes. I mean, with no protection. What will happen?
Well, it will burn your eyes, literally. It is the sun is so bright, you cannot stand to look at it, and it will burn the back of your eyes because it's just too much solar radiation. It's worse with an eclipse just because it's not so bright. I can look at it for a moment. Well, no, you can't. That it's still too bright, even though we will only see 10% of the sun. Well, you only get 10% of the blindness.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I mean that's not a situation you want to have. Again.
So it's the prolonged looking at the sun, which one is apt to do if there's an eclipse going on, that is the danger.
Absolutely.
It's not like you take a quick look and see the sun setting and then you look away type of thing.
Right, right, yeah. For sustained viewing, again, definitely use a safe way to cut down the light through, like these eclipse glasses. There are also other projection techniques. We have what's called a sun funnel, which will take a very small telescope and project it onto a 6-inch piece of material. So it gives you a good view of what's happening, but it does so in a safe manner. A regular telescope is intended to collect and concentrate light, and that's exactly the wrong thing. But there are solar telescopes, which are specifically designed to look at the sun and do the filtering, and those are perfectly normally used.
Will scientists be looking for any particular type of data? What will they be studying this eclipse for?
Oh, a number of things. Albert Einstein, in his theory of relativity, actually predicted that starlight would be bent around a body such as the sun. So you could take a picture during a total solar eclipse, which would look at the position of the stars. You could compare that to a time when the sun is not in the path and see if there is a difference in the position that you could see.
Well, some people with the ubiquitous cell phones, some people may be tempted to take a picture of this. Is that a bad thing to do? Is that a dangerous thing to do at this point?
It's probably not particularly dangerous if you are using the camera on your cell phone. The problem is that it will try to equalize the exposure based on the brightness. And if you're pointing directly at the sun, you will get a very short exposure. And so that's unlikely to turn out well.
What else should people be looking for when in this experience?
The event itself is almost magical. What is happening, again, the moon is going across the United States 3,000 miles in about an hour and a half. So if you figure that, that's traveling at about 2,000 miles an hour. In those last moments before totality, you can actually see the shadow as it's coming towards us. So that's one of those aspects which, until you've seen it, it's hard to imagine how fast the moon is traveling.
Why does this happen? What causes this phenomenon?
It's simply an alignment. That's one of the fun things about astronomy. When we are looking at something, we imagine a line. We're at one point on the line, and what we're looking at is at another point on the line.
We think in a linear fashion.
Exactly, just linear. So when other bodies, other astronomical bodies, are on that same line, magical things happen. In the case of if you have a small body between us and a larger body, it's what's called a transit. And we will see transits of some of the minor planets. From our point of view, we've had a transit of Venus and a transit of Mercury in recent years. We won't see another transit of Venus in our lifetime, but we would see other transits of Mercury.
Have you ever seen a solar eclipse before?
I've seen two of them. The first one was in 1979, and we went to Lake Winnipeg in Canada in February. Oh, it was cold.
You must have wanted to see that eclipse.
It was an opportunity of a lifetime, and I'm just always happy that we took that. But it was a beautiful, cold, clear day, and we were able to see that shadow of the moon as it passed across. The magical thing about a total solar eclipse is when it is finally in totality, you look up, you see a black sun surrounded by the white corona. Again, it's that kind of moment, that kind of sight that raises the hairs on your arms. It's something very special.
What was the other time?
The other time was in 1997, and we were on a cruise ship in the Caribbean. And that was a lot more comfortable because it was warm, but we also had wonderful conditions and saw this beautiful event.
Well, it seems as if you just love astronomy. What got you interested and why is it a good hobby to pursue?
Oh, there's just an amazing number of things that you can look at in the sky. Many of them beautiful, many of them mysterious. I've been looking up at the sky for all of my life. I remember well going out to see a meteor shower and lying in the lawn out when we were living far from the city. It's just a fun hobby. We have lots of interesting people that are members of our local astronomy club. We have a lot of activities going on there. So it's just very enjoyable.
Where will you watch the eclipse this time?
I will be in Carbondale, Illinois. We have a number of activities which are happening in that area. It is in the path where the total eclipse will occur. That is, we're far enough south that we will be directly in line with the sun and the moon will completely cover the sun. So that total eclipse is the a major difference, a world of difference between that and even what the 90% of an eclipse that we will have here.
In central Illinois, 90%, 93%.
Mm-hmm. So yes, we will definitely be in the path of totality, which is only about 100 miles wide. And we will be looking forward to that short 2-minute process where the moon goes across the sun.
Lee Green is with the Twin City Astronomers. He spoke with GLT's Judy Valente. The Twin City Astronomers will give a presentation about the eclipse on July 29th from 9 to 11 p.m. They will also have a laser-guided sky tour and telescope observing at Funk's Grove. You can learn more about this story and read other local stories on our website, wglt.org.
One, two, three, four.
Our website is WGLT.org, where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or individual interviews today with help from Charlie Schlenker and Judy Valente. It's also where you can find contact information to let us know what you think of the show or share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM. On Twitter, we're WGLT News, or you can tweet us using the hashtag Sound Ideas. This is GLT and WGLT.org, 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.